Welcome to the APCDA podcast. This is your host, Ruchira Tripathi, and you're listening to the Voice of Industry. In today's episode, we will be talking about renewable energy landscape and the opportunities that this emerging field presents to our clients. I'm here with Vignesh Nandakumar, the CEO of Serentica Energy, that delivers round-the-clock sustainable energy to hard-to-abate industries. Vignesh has had diverse experience in developing and growing renewable energy investments to the tune of $1 billion across India, Southeast Asia, South Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa. He's also seasoned in raising funding capital, M&As, business development, project execution, and in managing company operations. Apart from renewable energy, Vignesh is passionate about electric vehicles and the shared and circular economy. He's also an angel investor and mentor to startups in the industry. Welcome to the show, Vignesh.
Yeah, thanks, Ruchira, for having me here.
Before we start, I want to add a disclaimer that the views expressed on the podcast are that of my guest and are not reflective of his organization. Vignesh, I want to start with the spotlight on you. When we met personally almost 15 years ago, sustainability and you were nowhere connected. I think you were working at Seagate at the time. So share with us what your journey has been like from an engineer in non-renewables to where you are now.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. You're right. I think the time I spent in Science Park was in a completely different field, research and physics and hard disk drives. What happened subsequently was I was very interested with the area of development that is going on in many parts of the world. And I was actively seeking ways that I could be part of it in a more meaningful and a full-time way, rather than, of course, there are many ways to engage on a not-for-profit and supporting not-for-profits as well. And I was finding, trying to find this ikigai intersection, something that I'm passionate about, something I'm good at, and something I'd enjoy doing. And in that exploration, it led me to choosing sustainable energy as one of the pathways, wherein my technical knowledge and my understanding of what was going on the ground, both from a technology implementation perspective, and I learned a lot of the realities of financing and adoption along the way. So it intersected there, and that, one thing led to the other. After Singapore, I had moved back to US for a few years, but I decided to pack up, move to India. There's a lot of action going on in the renewable energy sector in 2009-10, and ended up joining a renewable energy company that was being set up for Asia Pacific operations from the US called Sun Edison. And Sun Edison went on to become one of the largest renewable energy companies in the world, with operations all across the globe, right from Far East in Japan, Southeast Asia, India, Sub-Saharan Africa, Europe, Latin America, pretty much every continent, of course, North America as well. And that seven-year stint, I held a lot of diverse roles, which led me to explore and open up markets in Southeast Asia for the business. I spent a fair amount of time, almost 3 years in South Africa, building the business in the Sub-Saharan African region. So what really changed somewhere was that renewable energy, from being seen as a nice to have and very expensive and perhaps only in the domain of countries that could afford them because it was expensive, that slowly morphed into it becoming a mainstream. It went from a nice to have to a must have. And every country, both developing economies and developed economies, needed to have a pathway to decarbonize their energy consumption, because each one of these countries was also increasing their per capita consumption.
Yeah.
And of course, the climate change imperative put a huge spotlight on this, energy being one of the largest contributors to the carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah.
Power production in particular. So I think sort of, the tailwind started to grow, and where I am today, I would say in what is probably the 3.0 version of the renewable energy industry from even when I started. And I'm sure there were many versions before I joined them as well.
Interesting, very interesting. Do you think, looking back, do you think there were some critical decisions that you took that kind of allowed you to pivot and positively impact your career in the renewable space?
Certainly. I think, when you have a thing going very well, and I was doing very well in Seagate, I was in the US, comfortable life, and of course a very global company, right? An MNC, very well established. One of the questions you want to ask yourself is what drives you to wake up every morning, right? What I found is the work at Seagate was very exciting, but this whole thing of impact at a ground level was in many ways driving me to ask questions, what more could I do? And I could have done many things with Seagate itself, but something moved me to be on the ground, and it's a personal choice. The decisions I took at that time was to actually really pack up and leave, right? I did not have any alternatives at that time, but it was not an unthought through decision though, because many people, and I don't want to make it sound like it was a wild west exploration. What I did plan was to spend a year doing my MBA at the Indian School of Business in Hyderabad in India, which would give me access to a lot of people that I could meet, because it's one of the very reputed institutions. And in there, I stood out because I was do very well in an academic system that was sort of a good mix of East and West pedagogies, right? So, that 1 year was definitely planned. Beyond that year, I didn't have much of an idea, but this 1 year was definitely planned. So that was one big decision. The second decision was, as I was going through this, obviously it's a year's program by INSEAD, and a year is not a long time actually. By the time you're halfway through, it goes very fast. The main question that came up was, do I go through the placements, which are very well organized and offered by the Indian School of Business, or do I try and find my own opportunity? And there, I used to be spending a lot of time with professors outside of class. I'd go to them with these dilemmas. And I'd ask them, what have you seen? Because they've seen thousands of students before me. Business school as a means of career shifts. In those conversations, what emerged was, you've got the background, you've got WorkX, you're doing an MBA after WorkX, it's a good school. So if really you're passionate about this, and you should give it all you got. So I sat out of placements and I started visiting conferences and meeting people in the sector I wanted to join, and give myself 6 months to find something to do there, right? So those were two critical decisions. The first one being, move to the place you want to be, because you'll naturally find more things you can do. And B, make some choices, studied choices, but make some choices on what you want to prioritize in terms of your options.
Right. I would like to shift gears a bit, Vignesh, to the renewable energy landscape. There's a lot of talk about climate deadline, for example, that's in the focus now, to reduce emissions in half by 2030, to achieve net zero by 2050. And when we say net zero, we only mean carbon neutrality. We are not even talking about reduction. We are just saying what goes in is equal to what comes out. So even for that, getting countries to commit to net zero is still a work in progress. On the other hand, I read this report by the International Renewable Energy Agency, IRENA, I think that's how they call it, where they highlighted that, of course, solar and wind are the cheapest sources of energy, and they are at least, I think, 60% of renewables are now cheaper than coal. My question is, after this long kind of introduction, why are we not able to move faster towards a net zero target? Is it just politics, or are there other practical challenges? Because if you look at it, it seems pretty clear that renewables are more cost efficient. So why is it not happening?
I think it's a very, very interesting question. We should continue to always ask ourselves. And the reason to do that is to continue this exploration is to see what can we do more and what can we do faster. Right? But why does that question not have a clear-cut answer today? The reason for that is twofold. One is, you mentioned politics, but I will combine politics plus country economics on one side, right? Mm-hmm. The second is the technology itself, and you know what we are getting used to, the immense technological change that has happened that has impacted many aspects of our lifestyle. So on the first one, we have to understand that the incumbent source of electricity or power, like coal and oil and gas, they are very vast, very deep sectors that have developed over decades. I would even say more than a century. That's a technology that has come through maturity with continuous refinement, continuous sort of investment as well. And at a point of time, and I would say in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they were the largest drivers of employment in many, many, many economies, right? So they drove a lot of the economics and the policies as well. And we continue to have the impact of those policies as we stand today. And it's very hard to just go reverse them with just a single policy, right? Because they're many interconnected sort of implementations of the grid also that affect them. So that is on the incumbent side, right? And therefore, policy change has been happening. It has been slow for the simple reason that a policymaker, whether a bureaucrat or a politician, is faced with the choice of, you know, what is the right thing for the economy? What is the right thing for the jobs to the people I represent? And what is the right thing for the investment that needs? Do I have the money for it? The taxpayer? Now, where are my taxpayer dollars spent? And this is something that I realized very deeply working across countries like Thailand, Malaysia, India, South Africa. Because there's a lot of choices or there are a lot of quote-unquote zero-sum choices on allocation of public capital. And I mean public capital, not private capital. Now, what is the best place to put it? Is it for education, healthcare, power, jobs, infrastructure? There's so many pulls and pushes that a country is faced with. So, it's naturally given renewable energy itself started becoming commercially viable about 5, 6, 7 years ago, compared to a system that's been there for decades. It's natural that the pace of change is going to pick up only now. That said, I think the double whammy of the impact that is visible today of the climate change, and that the financial sector has understood how it can de-risk itself in investing into renewable, has actually accelerated it faster than I would have thought. For example, in 2010, solar panels were selling at about $3 a watt peak, right? And they were very large panels, 200 watt peaks was the largest, which would have required acres and acres. Today, the panels have increased 2.5 and close to are becoming 3 times in size, have become at least 25% more efficient, and are close to 1/10 the cost, or less than 1/10 the cost, right? So that brings me to the second point, which is that the pace of technology change also has started rapidly picking up only in the recent years, right? So once people get comfort that this is a viable technology, once the governments have comfortable that with this, I am still adding jobs and I'm not net zero on jobs, this is a very big consideration. This was a raging debate even in the US for a long time. And now studies have proven that the renewable energy sector contributes as much, if not more, jobs than the thermal energy sector. Right? It still leaves one big question on the sort of the technology and the overall adoption side, which I think the human race will address, is renewable energy, whether it's solar or wind or hydro, is still based on natural movements of elements, which we don't control. Uh-huh. So, you know, whereas the amount of control you have over a coal or a oil-based generation is enormous. I mean, you can pretty much ramp it up or down as you wish, which you can't do with renewable, right? And this thing is called intermittency. So how do we address intermittency, both from a consumption adaption and from a generation perspective, is one, I would say, the last challenge before renewable becomes, you know, sort of the largest energy solution, right? So what we will find is, for the next, in my mind, the next decade or so, we will find a cohabitation of these various technologies, where increasingly coal will be the stabilizing source, or gas or oil will become the stabilizing source, and renewable energy starts becoming the primary source. But because of this intermittency, we need technologies, the older technologies and new technologies like storage, to help us meet this intermittency, so that when we and you and I turn on the switch in our houses, there is no shortage of power when we want. And that's a lifestyle we have become used to, right?
Yes.
So if you went and asked people, don't use power in the night, use only when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing, that's not going to be possible anymore, right? So we're going to see a transition where coal is going to continue to be relevant, or gas is going to be relevant, but it'll be used as a balancing. And then we'll see what new technological breakthroughs come. And this in itself provides massive job opportunities, because it's not a simple solution to solve. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm an electrical engineer, so I'm going to sort of hark back to some of that. You know, when you generate an electron, if you don't consume it immediately, it is lost forever, right? So when you're powering something, right, the complexity of making sure you have generated so much energy, where do I send it to immediately, based on the demand matching, based on, you know, how do I give incentives for people to match demands? There's going to be so much data analytics involved in this. There's going to be, another layer of interesting demand supply play that comes in when mobility becomes electrified. Like, you know, when cars are electrified, can I give people incentives? Can I suddenly send them a message saying, if you plug in your car right now, power is going to be cheap, right? All of that is, you know, we are at the very tip of the iceberg to see all of that. So I think inherently the reason that the adoption has been slow is there are legacy issues that we need to understand. It's not a moral debate. It's a very practical, energy transition is a very practical challenge. And therein lies the opportunity for more and more careers and jobs to be created.
It's an interesting point you made, Vignesh, about the cohabitation of various sources, because for people like me who are not in the space, when you talk about adopting renewable energy, for me, it seems like the switch is going to be immediate. But as you pointed out, it's not, and it can't be, because of, you know, a number of issues that you highlighted, especially technology. We're not there yet, maybe in terms of technology, but getting there. So thank you for highlighting that. Now, if you look at the Asia Pacific and the Middle East region, which countries, in your view, do you think have a focused push towards renewables and also are balancing it with the government policies? Because the government policies then create demand and jobs. So could you share a little bit on that?
Sure. In fact, the good thing about this region that you mentioned is pretty much every large economy is having a push, including the Middle East. You know, for example, if I go from west to east, the Middle East, Dubai and Saudi Arabia, the broader UAE, they have a massive push towards solar and wind for also creating new cities, right? powered by renewables, like sustainable cities, right? In the middle of the desert. So in fact, Saudi Arabia, as we speak, is building one of the largest solar installations in the world at one of the most cost-effective price points.
Mm-hmm.
So the policy there is, now why would a oil-rich country do that? Right? I think it makes immense sense because it helps conserve oil for them to use it to make the oil last longer than just, you know, run out of all the extraction that is possible. So if you can add another 50, 60, 70 years to the consumption of oil, it's very beneficial for these countries as well, right? So Saudi Arabia is doing, and UAE are doing it in a very big way. Oman is looking to be sort of the center of that whole area where it can interconnect the rest of Asia into the Middle East. And going in Egypt as well, right? Egypt is looking to become a big hub of hydrogen in addition to being a hub of renewable and sort of become the gateway from the Middle East into Europe and vice versa. So, you know, I think that whole region is seeing a lot of activity. The policies are supportive for large installations in those regions. Moving eastward, you know, the economies that can offer are doing it in a very big way. Obviously, India has made this a very large priority. There's a lot of now new policies being enacted that would make the grid a lot more green, that would allow for private sector customers. Till now, it was the government pushing renewable through procurement programs that it would run. But now they're easing up the rules for private sector customers to who are traditionally customers of DISCOMs, of the distribution companies, to procure renewable energy directly. So I think there's a lot of action in India, and you know, east of UAE, I would place India as one of the larger markets. A very tough market because it's a very price-sensitive market, but a very large market. Bangladesh, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, in a very big way, a lot of procurement Singapore wants to do for this power from renewable. Moving into China, of course, is one of the largest installers of renewable power on an annual basis, apart from being, I would say, the largest manufacturer of solar and wind technology. And then when you go further east, Korea, Japan, and Australia, right? Again, a lot of them doing good work in policies to tap into distributed generation, as well as, like, you know, where land is a premium in a country like Japan. There's a lot of push towards offshore wind installations that can be installed, you know, 15, 20 kilometers into the sea and brought through undersea cables. Now, when things like that happen, you know, there's so much opportunity even for the cable manufacturing sector. There's opportunity for the marine sector. There's opportunity for you know, people, erstwhile oil and gas offshore, they understand offshore very well. The skill set of building these things require very similar skill set.
Exactly.
So these are the countries, I would say, in the arc that are pushing in a very big way. Storage is going to come up. A lot of R&D happening even in Singapore in storage. And I think that's going to be a very, very big opportunity as well. And Singapore, I think, is also positioning itself to be the hub of financial investment gateway for foreign investors to invest into these regions.
Yes, I remember that we recently launched this stock exchange for trading of carbon credits. So you mentioned something about transmission and distribution. So, I mean, if I were to think about the buckets or the core work of renewables, I understand there are three buckets, one of which, as you said, is transmission and distribution, other is storage, and of course, then you have the generation. And you also pointed out that these buckets may not be equally developed. I mean, we are ahead in some of the buckets, but in things like storage, we still have a lot of work to do. So when it comes to, you know, getting talent, peripherals may play an important role in you know, this space where there are certain areas that are not developed. Could you then share about some main peripheral industries that you think would feed into renewables and kind of promote the work that they are trying to do?
Sure. So, you know, the entire the power equipment industry involved in transmission and distribution, which supplies into this sector, has a very, very big role to play and will see a lot of growth. And what I mean by that is the renewables, both solar and wind, also have geographic specificity. You know, there are certain areas where they're much better. There are certain areas where they're not great, right? So if we want to increase the penetration of renewables, we have to build the pipes to take the power from where it can be generated very well and in high quantities to where it is needed in high quantities. And you know, for all we know, you know, whether it's Singapore or whether it's Mumbai or, you know, Jakarta, you know, putting generation right next to the city might not be the best resource of renewables. So we, you know, we'd have to build lines and pipes. And when we do that, we also have to build pumps. And and these are transformers. And you know, do we do AC lines? Do we do DC lines? I mean, the entire industry segment in that, you know, the conductors and the cables, all of those industries become mainstream in developing renewables, right? And today, the biggest roadblock for more renewable adoption is actually not just the availability of more efficient solar and wind technology. It's also the availability of the grid, both power and the grid enhancement that has to happen closer to the customer, right? So, and closer to the customer, you have a lot more peripherals. You have your last mile transformer, you have your cabling, you have your meters. You know, what if tomorrow you're able to charge the car? And by the way, you as a customer can, when suddenly somebody else has a higher demand, can sell the charge in your car. And so you become what is called a prosumer. You're both a producer and a consumer.
Yeah.
And all of this requires the peripherals, in like the meter in your house, to be changed. It has to become a two-way meter. It has to be able to tell what time of the day, how much power flowed. And ideally, you want all of this to be recorded digitally and remotely so that you are not having to check everything. Right,
yeah.
And everything becomes computer traced and computer built. So, you know, the entire last mile peripherals will undergo a change, and so you'll have a big change in the transmission equipment and the distribution equipment and the peripherals that are closer to home as well. Right. Another big part of this industry is energy efficiency. So we talk about changing the source of energy, from fossil fuels to renewable. But there's also a lot of things that can be done on having more efficient bulbs, efficient fans, efficient geysers, every equipment that we use, whether in the house or in a factory, become more efficient. There's a study that says you could impact almost 10-12% of the, you can reduce the consumption by 10-12% just merely by making everything more energy efficient.
Yeah.
Right? Then that's an explosion, right? Like if your computer can run for twice as long at half the charge, like that whole peripheral industry is going to explode. Right? And it is actually. So I think energy efficiency is another big play that will be part of this this change.
When we were speaking a couple of days back, you mentioned about the sector being very dynamic, and wherever we have, you know, dynamic and emerging, talent can be an issue. Talent is always an issue. You know, good talent is always difficult to find, but it may be more so in an emerging field. So could you also share about the challenges that you face when you hire talent?
Sure. I think one of the biggest challenges we face is, unlike other traditional in power sector industries in general, the amount of formal and direct training that's given at the college level is far less compared to the demand. Right now, we are seeing universities have courses and spend time.
Yes.
But, you know, I think it's going to take at least another 5 to 7 years before the skill gap between demand and supply is met, right? Mm-hmm. Because the people who we have today have mostly learned all of this on their own and, you know, have gone to certification courses post college and, of course, learned on the job. So at the entry level, we find that people have good basic skills, but you know, renewable energy specific understanding out of college is still much lower than where it ideally it should be, right? Mm-hmm. Now that leads to an increasing gap as experience grows, because you know, people immediately join where they can be useful, and you know, it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to take that risk and say, let me get into renewable, and we are seeing that now, but you know, it's not as mainstream as could be. So technical talent in particular, I would say, still is not in the quantum that we need, of the quality that we need. The other piece is, you know, there's in the last 5-6 years, as the understanding of the technology has grown, more importantly, data has exploded. You know, data costs and data connectivity have become far cheaper. The cloud is now a very big part of our lives, right, in the last 5 to 7 years. All of this has allowed for computing to be, centralized or decentralized as we wish. And, you know, trained statistical modelers, trained people who understand how to mix statistics with the energy modeling of a grid, that's an application of very deep statistical knowledge and power engineering knowledge. And those kind of, I would say, the cross-disciplinary, training is also somewhat limited, right?
Okay.
So, from that sense, I think there's a lot of opportunity for people who have this kind of skills to grow. And, thanks to the pandemic, what's also happened is, except for jobs that require physical presence, which would be largely construction, could largely be sales, maybe to some extent the financing, a lot of these jobs in design, engineering, fine-tuning, quality, inspection, it's now become possible for people and skilled people from anywhere in the world to be engaged in it, right? The only limitation is where people want to be. So in fact, you know, I have somebody who works for me, who has two other clients. One of them is in Japan and the other is in Europe. And it's interesting that this person actually sits in one of the remote towns in India and has a clientele that where they're able to bill up to $600,000-$700,000 a year, dollars, right? So the pandemic has made that happen. There are many people like that. There are many people who are able to do this for remote locations in Africa, in Australia. And what has now become very clear is, if you have the right skill sets, if you have the right learning temperament, because it's a very dynamic field, and you're able to stay flexible, there's a lot of opportunity to even do startups and do this kind of remote work, right?
Yeah.
Thanks to the pandemic. But there will still be certain things that you can only do, given the geography that you have to be in. Regulatory, for example. You can't sit in India and do regulatory for some other country, or vice versa. So those become skill sets that are very, very high in demand locally as well. So, this is one of the challenges we face, is the quantum of college instruction, formal and cross-disciplinary. And one of the things that I do is I encourage students to think about economics, policy and energy in one of the courses I sort of co-teach. I think people also have to understand that things don't sit in isolation. So if you want renewable energy to grow, people have to understand, why would anybody fund it? Why would a customer buy it? And a lot of it is driven by policy, it's driven by reality of economies. And I think that understanding would be very helpful.
mean, you did speak about certain skill sets and the gap, but if we look at the other side, have you seen certain careers that are kind of now becoming more popular? You, for example, you talked about, stats and the integration with the engineering modeling. But, you know, are there very obvious emerging roles and careers that you would like to share with our listeners today?
Absolutely. So I'll start from the technical side and touch upon, also non-technical careers that are emerging, right? So on the technical side, everything that is to do with DC power, what is to do with technology that can help create what is called digital twins of operating power plants, which is analytics plus understanding the issues and being able to troubleshoot remotely or create proactive measures to fix problems remotely. Those have become mainstream. So DC related, what is DC's direct current related technical skill sets, and that is largely in the solar and storage space. So this is, today you will have engineers who are specialized in that, who weren't there about a decade ago. So that's one skill set. The second is, I mentioned the statistical modeling itself, because, like I said, the electron is generated now, its expiry date is a few microseconds. So if at all. So, and the grids are very, very complex networks. So understanding the network theory, understanding how statistics would play for generation and scheduling of this power, and doing that interplay with renewable, which is a very intermittent source, with thermal, with maybe even nuclear, all of that, I think there's just so much work to be done, right? And this modeling is going to be a very important skill set. As the technology itself becomes more sophisticated in wind and solar, the ability to predict how much to generate, and this leads me to the non-technical side, which is, the entire insurance sector wants to know what are the risks that it has to underwrite, what are the probabilities of failure, right? And there you need core technical skills and core analytical skills. It's exposed in a very big way to renewable energy, and therefore, you will have a lot of non-technical, what I mean by non-engineering skills, that you would have to apply. The financing industry, likewise, needs skilled people who can understand these opportunities, be able to help with capital allocation in a realistic manner. And last but not the least, the legal profession. There's a lot of new types of contracts being drawn up. There are new risks that have to be taken care of. There are new conditions and terms that have to be put in for renewable that, you didn't even have to think of for thermal or for oil and gas. I think there's a lot of innovation that the legal profession will start seeing in the course of this development. And there's another whole area of skill sets that are emerging and are becoming high in demand, is your ESG and your environmental safety and planning. That is a very, very core skill set. We find dearth of good people there.
I'm curious, is there a certain type? And when I say type, I'm talking about maybe characteristics of people who work in the renewable energy sector. Because I remember when we were hiring for the social service sector, we found that there were certain characteristics that applied across the sector, irrespective of the job that, the people were doing. So we had things like resilience, compassion, passion for service. They played out differently depending on the job that they were doing, but they still applied. So is there something like that for the renewable space that, our listeners can maybe know about?
Yes, for sure. I do think this space needs people who have a little bit of an entrepreneurial mindset. Right? In that you are entering into a very promising space that everything is not figured out yet. A lot is going to get figured out in due course of time. Only now you're starting to see very large companies, but you know, it's still a handful compared to the other sectors where there are many, many large companies, and you could think of careers where you'd spend 8-10 years in a single company. Renewable is yet to see those kind of multi-billion dollar corporations, right? Your ability to stay agile and adapt your skill sets based on whether you're sitting in a generator, you're sitting in a financier, or you're sitting in a customer. Mm-hmm. Right? Because all three of them need people with the understanding of renewable energy or sustainable energy. But you know, you have to adapt yourself. So I think that adaptability is very key. The other piece is, I think you do need to have a core passion for the sustainability agenda, right? Mm-hmm. And the good thing is you can combine your passion with what you're good at and make money today, as opposed to it being a CSR activity. Yeah. But I think it's important to have the passion also because, you know, end of the day, that's what you're doing, right? And you're not just, anytime you walk on the street and you tell somebody, you know, I'm in the renewable energy sector, I can guarantee you 9 out of 10 times they're going to say, wow, you guys are doing a good thing for us, right? So in some ways, you represent that mission.
Yeah.
And I think the, having a passion for that sustainability goes a long way because it also helps you think through some choices that we will be making. I mean, nothing is perfect even in the renewable world, right? And you'll still find a lot of people having questions about, are electric vehicles really environmentally sustainable or not? Mm-hmm. You know, are the processes we are following for manufacturing these environmentally sustainable or not? And each person entering this industry is going to have an influence on the answer to that question. So I think these are the three things I would say, a fairly strong entrepreneurial mindset, because you still don't have these large, you know, hundreds of large corporations with very well set career paths. You have to be adaptable and, you know, having a passion for environmental sustainability.
Wonderful. We are almost out of time, Vignesh. Any final words for our listeners?
I really thank you for having me on this show. You know, I'm sure there are many people that you are counseling and your colleagues would be counseling who would be facing people with these questions. And I'm hoping that in my own small way, I've helped give some comfort if people are sitting on the fence or even considering renewable energy as a career to take one step further, either jump in or, you know, start spending more time to learn more. So I really wish that we see more people, more brilliant minds join this, which will only accelerate the pace of change towards sustainability. So, you know, thanks so much for this. And I wish all of them a lot of good luck and good strength to pursue this path.
Thank you, Vignesh. It's been a really interesting discussion. I don't know where the time went, but many, many thanks for this chat. I know that a lot of us will find all your comments and your insights very useful. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.